As the Five Nations Championship waits for the thaw to get underway again, we're reminded that if it's possible to have a voice that's honed to the sound of rugby football, Bill McLaren's got it. And it's not easy for a London Welshman to concede the point. He's not at all the fiction writer, sports commentator, not for him the fast lane of London life. He's a gentleman who loves to walk the mellow hills of the Scottish borders, who prefers the quiet life of the games master to the politics of the barroom. He loves his rugby and he relishes its stories. He's also, though, the professionals commentator. The shuttle for me from Heathrow to Edinburgh, a drive for Bill McLaren from his beloved Hoyk, and we talk together over a sandwich or two. Bill's a long time, isn't it, that you've been the voice of rugby? 30-odd years, I think, you've been going.
It's amazing, isn't it, how time passes. Yes, I was called to do an audition way back in 1951-52 when the great Springboks were here, Basil Kenyon Springboks. And it was a complete surprise to me. It was actually engineered in secret by my editor of the time, a local editor on the Hoyk Express. And I was persuaded, and that really is the word, he was a very forceful character, much against my will, to go down to Mansfield Park, our own local Hoyk ground, to do a 10-minute audition with six other chaps on the South of Scotland versus South Africa match. That was big stuff in those days, as you can imagine, Gerald. And I was quaking, absolutely petrified. I heard a recording of my bit later on, and the thing that struck me and that was brought home to me forcefully was the fact that although I'd mentioned players, I hadn't said where the game was. I hadn't said whether it was in the 25 or near the touchline, and that was the first lesson I remember vividly, having it driven home that I had to paint the whole picture as a radio commentator. And it's kind of mushroomed from there. I had a lovely quarter of an hour sandwiched between Rex Alston and G.V. Wynne-Jones, who were the great radio commentators of the day, at a Scotland-Wales match at Murrayfield. And that kind of launched me in a way. I became Scotland's sort of radio rugby commentator, and it developed from there. I have to say that I was greatly indebted to Rex Alston in particular in those early days, because he was a delightful gentleman for a start, and he was so keen to help someone like myself, and it was so important in those days to be aided and to be launched in a sense. I can remember once before a France-Scotland game in Paris, he spent half an hour ensuring that my pronunciation of Gérard Dufour was absolutely dead right, and I got pretty fed up with it before the end of it.
You still say it beautifully.
It's deteriorated a little bit since then.
But I just wonder why the editor of the Hoyk Express, why should he want to promote you as a radio commentator? Surely he wanted to promote you into some top job on his own newspaper.
Well, there wasn't a top job in his own newspaper. As you know, Gerald, it was one of those local newspaper things where I covered everything. Education committee, Women's Rural Institute meetings, and all the sport. It made you a kind of all-round journalist in a way.
Coroner's court. Did he
yes,
do that?
That's right. That kind of
police thing.
Police call. Up to the police station every morning at 9 o'clock to find what had happened overnight. Yes, lovely stuff. And John Hood, a very fond memory. I mean, he drove us hard at our work, but he was a man for whom I had tremendous respect. And he was the BBC's correspondent in Hoyk. I had to report all the lamb sales, for instance, and any bits of news. And it just had occurred to him on the quiet that I was awful keen on rugby statistics and keeping notes of what players had done and so on. And so he wrote to the BBC and said if ever they needed anyone, that I might be quite a useful person to have. And as I say, it was a complete surprise to me. When I got the letter from the BBC inviting me to the audition, I threw it in the bucket. I thought the other lad in the office was having me on. And it was only a week later when Mr. Hood said, "You're not heard from the BBC." And then I protested no, and that I wasn't going under no circumstances. And as I say, he was the one who really pushed me along.
So originally then, you were a radio man.
Oh, very much so, yes. I loved it, really, because in those days, when you were due to start, you just got a wee tap on the shoulder, and you knew you had to describe everything, that the audience, in a sense, was blind, and so you had to paint the whole picture, and I liked doing that. It kept you rolling along. I tell you, it's a strange thing how events come about, Gerald, because my father reminded me when I first started in radio commentary that when I was a boy of 9, 10, 11 and 12 years of age, that I used to write up stories of athletics championship matches with all the great British athletes of the day, and that I used to organize athletics competitions in our own avenue with my friends, my school friends, and that I used to sit on the dike or on the wall and do commentary as they did the races. Quite a nice way of organising things, as you can see. I got the soft bit, as you can imagine.
Well, it's interesting. Tony Lewis wrote that he suspects that the best commentators are either actors or instructors. And in fact, you're an instructor. You're a school teacher.
That's right. I think that's been helpful in a sense in my commentary, especially in switching to television, because I've always felt that rugby union was a complicated game, and certainly for the uninitiated. And I always had the feeling that with the grandstand audience, for instance, a great many people viewing weren't really rugby addicts. They weren't specialists at all. And initially, I did have this feeling that I had an obligation in a way to explain some of the finer points, to explain why the scrummage was turning, why those forwards were peeling out the back of the line-out.
But that's the teacher in you, isn't it, coming out there?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's so helpful, too, in my teaching, because, you know, in one of the parts of the preparation for a rugby commentary is to go along and see the international side practicing the day before. And going along there, of course, is a great joy for me, because I can then go back to my own schools, and when I'm coaching my rugby boys in the afternoons, I'll often get the opportunity of saying, "Now, look, chaps, I was watching England on Friday afternoon at the runabout, and I saw Big Bob Hesford do it this way, or it was very strange, but this is how they were." And as soon as you mention a name of a player that they've seen on television, instantly the reaction is there.
And, of course, being a celebrated commentator, that turns you into a sort of hero to them. I'm sure they're very proud of their sportsmaster.
Yeah, I get some lovely comments, Gerald, I have to tell you. You know, one wee girl, only 7 years of age, one morning, on Monday morning at Burn Foot School, the class were just leaving, and she stopped and said, "Please, sir, my mother says you wear a wig on television." So I had to let her pull on my hair and things like that. But you're quite right. They do look up to people who are on television. And in every sense, it's been tremendously helpful to me as a teacher.
Are you ever concerned that the youngsters, the schoolboys, are picking up from television, from watching television, some of the vicious play that we've seen in rugby over the last 2 or 3 years?
I was at one stage, and I think you mentioned 2 or 3 years, and 2 or 3 years ago, I thought that rugby was becoming a dirty game, and unfortunately far too many people were seeing the kind of dirty play that there was. I had occasion, you know, to say to a youngster at line-out, 11 years of age, "What are you doing with that elbow up there? We don't coach you in doing it." "Oh," I said, "I saw it on television." Mm. And so I think there's a great onus, Gerald, on all the great players, you know, no matter how famous they are, no matter how competitive they are or committed they are, there is a great onus on them to try and show the game in its best light to the thousands and thousands of young people who are watching.
So how long had you been doing the rugby on radio, where you were the sort of Scottish rugby radio voice?
Yes, I've followed on after Jock Weems, who is a wonderful character, and another fellow for whom I've tremendous happy memory. And then I think about 18 years ago, I was asked to switch to television. I have to say I wasn't awfully keen about it, because I like the simplicity of the radio broadcast, where, as I say, somebody tapped you on the shoulder and you just got on with it.
Not quite like that now, Bill.
So they tell me.
They wear headphones.
The headphones. Now that you mention headphones, I tell you, I'll never forget the first time I had to wear headphones for television. Because, of course, what many of the viewers don't appreciate is that when you're doing your commentary, you have headphones on because you've got to listen to what the producer's saying. He may want to alert you to something. He may want to tell you something. And also, of course, you can hear what the main studio is saying to your producer, and what your producer sometimes is saying to his cameraman, which often is unprintable. And so you have all this going on in your ears. And I must say, initially, it upset me quite a bit, and I didn't fancy it at all. I've become accustomed to it now. Over the years, you learn what you need to listen to and what you can forget about. But initially, I didn't like it at all. And I also had some difficulty in in being able just to add to the picture. I don't think really I've achieved it yet. I still talk too much. But I think that initially I tended to talk a lot more than I need have done. And I've had to temper that just a little bit.
Now, your feel for the game of rugby football isn't that of many commentators like myself, in that you were you were not just a rabbit as I was at tennis. You played very nearly international rugby.
Yes, I suppose it's the one great disappointment of my whole life. And the one regret I'll take away with me is the fact that I didn't play for Scotland at rugby. I would love to have done, even just once, would have been great. I played in a Scottish trial, and I played for a Scottish 15 against the Army at Murrayfield. That was a kind of extra trial. Unfortunately, I got offside at the first scrummy, so that I was battling uphill from the start. But really, the main problem for me was that just when I was beginning to maybe knock on the door a bit, I developed tuberculosis, pulmonary tuberculosis. Which had been caused by war service in the Mediterranean. And that put paid to my rugby career. It was as simple as that. And eventually I finished up in East Fortune Hospital, having been told that I would be in my back for 4 years, which was, I mean, just knocked the bottom out of my whole situation, because I just started teaching, and I'd always wanted to be a teacher, and here I was faced with this 4 years in hospital, which really knocked me down for a good long time. But I was fortunate in that at the time they were experimenting with a new drug called streptomycin, and the doctors had picked half a dozen of us, and I suppose in a sense we were kind of guinea pigs. And I just happened to be the lucky one, Gerald. It worked with me. The other five lads had no great improvement at all, but the hole in my left lung, which was the size of a half crown, closed, you know, quite perceptibly every couple of months. So that I was up and about after about 19 months, and I was out in a couple of years. And I'd love to say just at this stage that there were a couple of doctors in East Fortune, Dr. Bill Murray and Dr. Biaggi. And you know how you look back on illness and feel a great debt of gratitude, but to those fellas, they were simply marvellous. In fact, Dr. Murray claims that my commentary work started in East Fortune, because when I was an up patient, I was persuaded to do some disc jockey stuff, playing records to all the people in the wards. And this developed to me doing commentary on table tennis. Now, Gerald, you can imagine me, that, you know, trying to keep tabs with table tennis. But that was pretty horrific, I should think. And we had putting competitions as well. And Dr. Murray always reckoned that that was the first commentary that I'd done of an official kind. And I suppose to some extent he was right. In any case, I got out of hospital. But, of course, I couldn't play rugby then, because it was a sort of recurring disease. You had to be very careful.
But you were well enough to be able to teach PE games or whatever they call it.
Eventually. It took 8 years for a vacancy to occur. I didn't want to leave my hometown of Hoyt. And so when the vacancy cropped up, of course, I immediately grabbed it, and have been very happy ever since. I always wanted to be a teacher of physical education. And so I really get the best of both worlds.
But the work you do for schools, three or four schools, isn't it?
Yes.
In Hoyt.
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
But that's a full-time job, though, isn't it?
Oh, that's a full-time job, yes, absolutely.
I mean, that's every day of the week?
Every day of the week. I'm in school usually about 8:45, and I scale about 4:00-ish, and I have four primary schools, and I go to the high school one afternoon a week, and that's quite hard work for an old fellow like myself, you know.
You're not just teaching them rugby, are you?
Oh, no, we do everything. We do gymnastics.
Not soccer, surely.
Well, we don't mention that. We don't speak about that too much in my way.
Do you?
Well, actually, I coach rugby, soccer skills. I really do. For one thing, it's quite helpful to great clumsy rugby forwards to use their feet a bit better than they do. And also, it's a game that boys enjoy. But our main thought, of course, down in Hoyt, Gerald, is rugby football, because it's the kind of number one religion. It's sort of rugby football, then Presbyterianism after that. And we tend to be very important insofar as that's concerned. We also teach dance just before the Christmas holidays. We were teaching the social dances for the school parties, and athletics, of course, gymnastics, and you know, all the other bits and pieces.
Why is it that the border towns, Hoyt and Gala, Kelso, places like that, why is it that rugby is so big there?
Initially, way back about 110 years ago, they tried out both the rugby football of the day, a sort of handling game, and the soccer code. And the story at the time was that the rugby game was found to be manlier and more congenial to the border nature. In other words, there were more thugs in the borders than anywhere else.
You love it, don't you? I mean, it's absolutely home to you.
Yes, I do. And the folk are great. They get on to you, know. They keep me on my toes. I mean, every time I go down Hoy Kai Street, it's a two-hour job, because everybody's asking about this or that. And in 1955, Jerry, you won't believe it, on a very murky day at Murrayfield in a Scotland-Ireland game, one of the Scots came from the far side of the field, ran, and I was certain it was Robin Charters, with whom I'd played for Hoyk. We got the head thrust forward, and it was only when he came over the 25 line, I realised it was Ian Swan, the wing, both having come, as I say, the visibility was desperate. And you know, 20 years after that, an old guy stopped me in Hoyk High Street, and I thought he was going to say, I did enjoy your gun. You know what he said? Do you remember your thing when you got cheered us wrong? So they always remember the bits you get wrong.
But I'm told that you've made produce of Hoyk very famous on the international scene. The Hoyk balls.
Oh, you're the sweet sort.
What exactly are they? I'm told you sort of hand these around to all the players.
Yeah, they're great things.
I've never heard of them.
There's a guy once said that if you were a kind of friend of Bill McLaren's, he got a Polamint. If he thought a bit more of you, you might get an Atlas Minto. But if you were really a top class, I mean, if he really thought most highly of you, you got a Hoyk ball. That's what he said. And they're the most delightful sweetmeats, which are made up a little dark close and in a little sort of button den at the back of nowhere. And yet they've gone all over the world. I used to take a tin with me to the internationals because they were quite pleasant before the commentary started, you know, for clearing the throat and giving you a nice minty flavour. And I once offered one to Gareth Edwards, and Gareth liked them quite a lot, so I took him down a tin. And I used to make the joke that, you know, half of his 20 tries that he scored for Wales were brought about because he'd had a Hoyk ball before. And Gareth used to hand them round the Welsh side. And when Mervyn Davies had his cerebral hemorrhage and was very, very ill, having taken place during a game, I wrote a wee note to him and enclosed a tin of white balls and said, look, you take two of those a day and you'll be as right as rain, just to try and perk him up. And a funny thing happened later. A friend of mine, Jim Nielsen, who has a sweet shop in the middle of Hoyk High Street, had two oldish folk come in, or middle-aged folk come in, and asked for a dozen tins of Hoyk balls. And they had Welsh accents, and when he got them and parcelled them up, he said, I hope you don't mind me asking, but you're Welsh, aren't you? How come? And they said, well, actually, we're Mervyn Davies' parents, and we've been at Pitlochry on holiday, and he insisted that we pop in to have it. So off they went with the dozen tins.
The BBC actually tried to get you and your wife to uproot yourselves from Hoyk and come down to the rather posh south.
Yes, very posh.
But you didn't want to do that, did you?
I didn't. I fancied the job, but I didn't fancy living down there in the very least. I think the idea was that I would do rugby during the winter and athletics during the summer and join the athletics group, and that would have been great fun because they're absolutely out the top draw. But to be honest, the thought of living down in London was just not on for me. Home provides lovely therapy after a broadcast. You well know there's a good lot of adrenaline flows during a broadcast. And I don't know about you, Gerald, but I feel after a commentary, you know, sort of flat a bit. You've given as much as you can. And I can go home and I can take the car and Bet and I can drive, you know, just a mile, and we're in the middle of nowhere. We're in the heather, we're amongst the hill birds and the hares, and you can walk for miles and not meet a soul, and it's the most marvellous therapy. Not suggesting that that can't be done down in the south of England, but it certainly never appealed to me, and you know, Hoyk's hame, isn't it?
But you see, that way you've managed to keep it all in perspective. It's very easy to go quietly bonkers about sport, isn't it? I wonder whether you went quietly bonkers when you were doing commentary on that unforgettable day at Murrayfield when Scotland beat the French to do the Grand Slam.
That was one of the great joys I've had in commentary.
Was that your greatest joy?
I think it was, yes. I've had one or two that have given me immense pleasure, but I'd said some years before that I had one great ambition, was to be doing the commentary when Scotland next won the Triple Crown. And to be honest, I was saying to them, for goodness sake, hurry up, because they were taking a long time about it. Actually, I was at the previous time, on the previous occasion when they won the Triple Crown, 1938, a marvellous game at Twickenham.
You must have been a small boy. So
yes, I was a schoolboy. I was just 12 and a half, 13. And my father and his factory friends had decided to go down on one of those Cook's tours by train. And one of my father's friends, Jock Dodds, had a son, and I was about my own age, and so I got along as well as company for him. And, you know, I think for about £3.12 and 6, you got down on the train, you got an orange, you had breakfast, I'll never forget it, because we were sitting in that huge east stand at Twickenham, beautiful sunny day, and not only did Scotland win with 5 tries, but I can remember my father pointing out to me, about 4 or 5 rows in front of us, some of the greats upon whom I'd been nurtured in a way, stories about them, Herbert Waddell, Max Simmers, G.P.S. McPherson. They'd won the Grand Slam in 1925, and as a very small boy, my father had told great stories about them. Doug Davis charging into a goalpost at Murrayfield, the post shivering, and Doug going over and scoring, getting up and running down the... and all that kind of thing, so that with that in mind, I really did have a keen desire to be doing the commentary when Scotland won the crown. I never thought for a moment that they would win the Grand Slam, and I would have been eminently satisfied with the Triple Crown. But that day when they beat the French was astonishing, because the French really should have won the game hands down. Mm-hmm. They had Scotland in a vice in the first half, played some lovely rugby, and then rather lost the head a bit. And, you know, when the final whistle blew and the Scots had done it, it was a marvellous thing for me.
Must have felt very emotional.
Yes, I did.
Was it difficult to be impartial in those circumstances?
No, I don't think so. I've always enjoyed good rugby football, irrespective of who played it. But I must say that the fact that it was Scotland, and they'd come back really from almost from the dead, as it were, and got that victory with that Calder try in the last moment, and the scenes at Murrayfield, the like of which we hadn't witnessed before, it really was something special. And that great euphoria, well, it's done. And that was wonderful, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Bill, before you drive off back to your beloved borders and a tin of hoik ball, a walk over the glen with your wife, I must ask you about the state of rugby. It seems not to be very healthy. The Australians really showed everybody how to play, didn't they?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I wish we could at least try to emulate them. You know, naturally, a lot of people say, "Ah, well, in this country, we don't get the same kind of weather, and we have to play in the wet a lot, and so on." And that's absolutely true. But I must say, they showed us so many lessons that if we don't take some of them to help to improve our game, our game might go backwards, and that would be a great sadness. Unfortunately, this overpowering desire to win, rather than to enjoy it and to sort of entertain people, if you like, that I think is the thing that we've got to be very, very careful about.
It's not necessarily the fault of professionalism, is it? I mean, it's something to do with striving for perfection.
Oh yes, I think there's a lot of money involved. I mean, even in rugby football, an amateur game, a lot of the unions are overplaying players simply in order to make big gates. I'm quite convinced of that. We have far too many tours. I'm quite convinced that the top players are being overburdened. They are having to sacrifice great things domestically, and I think also in work to some extent, in order to survive and to stay upside. And to be honest, that was never what rugby was meant to be. In my day, you trained on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you played on Saturdays, and that was it. The rest of the time, you was your own. Now it's almost a 6 to a 7 day week just keeping up sides with everybody, and that saddens me. And so I hope that we can ease the strain on players, and I hope that money doesn't come too much into it. We've all got to have cash to keep our grounds and all the rest of it. But I think that I would like to feel that rugby union will still remain a purely amateur game, because the game I knew was a joy to play in and a joy to watch.
There's a great story, isn't there, about that? I'm sure it couldn't happen today, but weren't the Scottish administrators some years ago so anxious that their players shouldn't be tainted by professionalism that the late Jock Weems, didn't they refuse to let him have a second pair of socks or something?
Oh, that was a lovely story told by Jock, and it was very true as well. He'd played for Scotland before the war, and he was picked for an international immediately after it. And when he arrived at the ground, of course, he went to see the secretary and said, could I have my jersey, please? And the secretary said, certainly not. You got one before the war.
And didn't he have to paint some socks on it?
Yes.
Black and white socks.
Absolutely true. The Scottish Rugby Union are still owe me 2 and 4 pence halfpenny for a rail trip I made from Hoyt to Edinburgh to play in a trial. I'd come back from Italy, from the war, demobbed, and I was picked for a Scottish trial. I didn't have time to see anybody, so I just went up and paid my own fare. 2 and 4 pence halfpenny or 4 and tuppence halfpenny return, I don't know. And when I went to get the money, they said, oh, well, you can't have the money. We'll give you another ticket. And I said, I don't want another ticket. I'm not going up to Edinburgh. And they still owe me 4 and tuppence halfpenny. And I mentioned this to John Law, the secretary of the Scottish Rugby Union, before he retired, but he just laughed.
2 last questions. One is that you are seriously influencing the vocabulary of the game. And I want to know, what does it mean if you're scluffing the ball?
Oh, that's a local one.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's like a golf shot that you top, where you hit the ball halfway up, and it just bobbles along, hardly off the ground at all. A sclaff.
I see.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you spell it. I think it's sklaff, but it's a sclaff.
Right.
And it's one used locally in Hoyt and about the border country.
You still find time with all the teaching and your family and the rugby, everything else. Still find time to play a lot of golf.
Yes, it's still a tremendous challenge. When you have a swing like mine, it's a genuine challenge.
Good player.
I was down to 6 handicap at one time, but I developed a loop at the top of my swing after damaging a shoulder. One of the great joys is that both of our sons-in-law, Derek Thompson, who's the ITV racing commentator and presenter, and Alan Lawson, who played for Scotland 15 times at scrum half, that I play a lot of golf against them, and to be quite honest, you know, I can beat either of them.
You can take money off them.
With my hand tied behind my back. It's one of the best sources of income I've got, actually.
And the other question, how long are you going to go on delighting us with your commentary?
It's awful nice of you to say so, Gerald. I'd love to just keep on doing it as long as I have the same interest in researching, as long as I feel the same zest for looking up the details and for sitting down. I've got the most wonderful wife in the world, because Bet knows that on the week of a commentary I have to go through into our dining room and just sit there with all the papers and my records floating about, and she has to sit in the lounge by herself for a while until I get all the details done. When I find that that's becoming burdensome, I would chuck it in, but I would love to keep on commentary work for as long as the BBC want me to do it.
And then what will you do when that day comes?
I'd like to write a book of some kind. I'm not sure what it would be, whether it would be on the game's tactics or on some of the experiences, or maybe one about some of the great tries I've seen. I'm not sure, but that might be in the pipeline, but I'll leave that until it comes along. I'd love to just keep plodding on the way I've done for quite a while, because I'm a very contented, happy fellow.